Welcome. I'm Dr. Marvin Candle, and this is the orientation film for Station 3 of the Parma Initiative.
Greetings. Welcome to another exciting episode of Pretentious Internet Theater. I am your host, Andrew Cook, and I am so leet, I care about the small people. Tonight, in our 23rd episode, a trio of stories inspired by ABC's Lost. Yes, you think I would have planned it this way, but in reality, no, I actually thought I would have gotten My Immortal done in the one shot. Live and learn. Whether or not you were satisfied with the series finale, know that this is why fan fiction exists. Because you don't have to be a qualified Hollywood writer to be able to get an audience. No, you can simply write fan fiction that perhaps changes the ending or expounds upon a small scene or inserts new scenes or flashbacks entirely or even inserts complete characters that are probably based off you. But I was inspired to do this episode. As a matter of fact, it reminds me of a quote by Chief Crowfoot, who says, "What is life? It is the flash of a firefly in the night. It is the breath of a buffalo in the wintertime. It is the little shadow which runs across the grass and loses itself in the sunset." My goodness, they lifted the entire series from that one quote. They completely ripped off Crowfoot. Let's get on with our story. Pretentious Internet Theater proudly presents, and now a reading of Buttock by Cafe Chan. Author's note.
I'm pretty ashamed of this, and not sure why my friend's making me upload it. Bear with me. XD! It's just stupidly stupid. Buttock is Button X-Lock shippering, laughs hysterically. One day, Locke was walking around through the jungle aimlessly. Then he tripped on something. "Ow! I tripped on something!" he exclaimed indignantly, checking to see what it was that made him stumble. He found it to be a pot of coffee, conveniently already full to the brim with the fluid. "Ooh, coffee!" Locke stated happily, picking up the pot and looking around for some sugar cream. Some conveniently fell out of a tree and hit him on the head. "Yay!" He dumped them both into his drink and started chugging, and chugging, and chugging. Before he knew it, the small buzz formed in the back of his head. Slowly, it grew bigger and more sporadic, and he felt like bouncing! He ran around in circles, screaming very manfully. However, he found himself ramming into another being at his fast pace. It hurt quite a lot. Looking up, he saw a towering, hairy monster. "Oh, wait, that's just Jack." "Whew." "Hey, Jack," Locke exclaimed, jittering about. Coffee's side effects were very evident. "Locke, are you okay?" Jack started to ask, concerned. "I can fix you," Locke yelled in reply. "No way! I've never felt better! Not a wannabe fixed!" Jack's eyes bugged out at the rejection. He began to bawl. Uninterested, Locke darted off, leaving Jack all alone with his flashbacks. "No one likes me! First Sarah won't let me stalk her, and now Locke won't let me fix him. He's obviously high on coffee. It is very dangerous." And Jack was right, for once. It was very dangerous. Because now, Locke was skipping around the beach singing the Barney theme song. Everyone was too afraid to ask him why he knew that song in the first place. "I love you. You love me. We're a happy family." Sawyer, whose face Locke was singing in, glared. "You better not be singing that to me," he said gruffly. "La la la, my little pony, my little pony." Locke hopped off, resembling a bunny. Sawyer was a little bit scared. Locke was sad and lonely. No one loved or understood him, and Claire seemed to be repelled by his advances. Charlie had punched him in the eye for that. Charlie punched like a butterfly, so it was okay. Locke, still high on coffee, skipped across the jungle in search of love. On the way, he ran into the island monster. It almost killed him. But once he exclaimed, "Will you be my girlfriend?" it ran away whimpering. Next, he approached a tree. "I like your branches. You're pretty. Will you be my girlfriend?" The tree dropped a coconut on his head. Locke received a mild concussion, but he was only out for a few hours, so that was okay too. Finally, Locke found himself in the hatch. It was empty, and the time was almost down to zero. So he entered those familiar numbers and watched things restore to normal. He paused and stared at the execute button. It was such a lovely shape. It always did what he asked it to. Then it dawned on him. "Button, will you be my girlfriend?" he asked with sparkly eyes. The button didn't reject him, so he took that as a yes. "Yay!" he exclaimed, glomping the keyboard affectionately. The button understood him. It didn't cause him physical pain. It didn't glare at him every time he smiled with an orange peel in his mouth, as was his daily ritual. This was true love! A warm, fuzzy feeling descended upon him, filling the empty void that had lived deep inside him for so long. That wasn't love, it was probably indigestion. But the former was preferable. And so, he decided to name the button. That way, he could put both their names on the wedding invitation, when he was ready for that commitment, of course. He liked the name Bob, but then he realized that was a guy's name, slightly problematic. So he changed it to Bobette. "I levels you, Bobette," he declared. "You're the only one for me." The button did nothing. Suddenly, Jack appeared and saw Locke hugging the keyboard whilst mumbling pet names for it. He stared. Locke saw Jack staring at him. He stared back. It was like a staring contest, only not. Locke randomly burst out giggling and said, "I lost!" Jack totally didn't get it, so instead he asked, "May I ask why you're cuddling that keyboard?" Locke's reply was, "No, you may not." So things were silent for a while. Jack, feeling awkward, finally said, "I'll leave you two alone." But as he turned to walk away, he added, "Can I be the flower girl at your guy's wedding?" Locke said blankly, "No, I want to ask Saeed." Jack cried and ran off. Locke ignored him completely. Saeed was thrilled. The end.
Well, that certainly was an interesting tale of romance that I've never heard explored before. As a reminder, you can email this podcast at thepitpodcast@gmail.com. Let's get on with our next story, shall we?
Pretentious Internet Theater proudly presents Deja Vu by Black Wolf 20. Disclaimer. I do not own Lost. I just enjoy the show. Author's note. In the need for more Little Ben stories, especially Little Ben interacting with the future Losties, I decided to write another, this one, as many of you should know, based on the infamous scene in Season 4's Cabin Fever, in which Hurley unexpectedly shares a familiar treat with the seemingly evil Ben Lannis. It was such a weird and amusing moment for me, I decided to fanfic a little history as to why Hurley did it. Why did Hurley share his snack with the villain? On a bright sunny day, two men found reasons to gripe as they lifted heavy boxes out of the back of a food van. They felt they had the right to complain about the amount of workload they'd been given in the kitchen for the afternoon. To Hurley, it was no big deal. He, along with Robert and Stuart, were unloading a new shipment of food and kitchen supplies for the Dama cafeteria. Where the initiative got them from, Hurley had no idea. Hurley didn't bother to ask. He simply did without bothering to know why. That was his philosophy, after all. Don't ask questions. Just go with the flow. He, as he often saw himself, was the kind of guy who made himself a salad and moved on. Of course, that salad might have to be accompanied with a nice big slice of pizza or a piece of fried chicken. It sounded good at the moment. A big slice of pizza with everything on it. Everything except the stamp of the Dharma Initiative. a real pizza from Pizza Hut, or any other pizzeria that was not on the island. That was a minor problem. It was no big deal. He felt it was time to start watching what he ate anyways. As he took a large box of canned vegetables into his arms, he looked over at Robert and Stuart. They were still complaining.
"Can't believe that, Rodney," said Robert. "Going to the floor, complaining about how I don't put my weight in the kitchen. I've done as much as he has. Now I got the rest of the afternoon to try and prove it." "At least you don't have to clean up after all of them," said Stuart. "Tables get pretty nasty. Those slime balls don't give a damn about us. Just order us around. I have a good mind to go up to Horace and demand off this stinkhole island."
"At least you guys aren't from the future, stuck in 1977, thought Hurley. Now that was something to complain about. At least it should be, but Hurley wasn't the type of person to get too upset over spilt milk, especially when the spilt milk was a few extra hours in the kitchen. It sounded like heaven to him. As Hurley moved back inside through the back door of the cafeteria, he thought how differently he had felt before he found himself another time, before he found himself on the island again. He was happy, or at least he was trying to be happy. But the lying he'd been instructed to do by his fellow castaways was slowly consuming him. It wasn't a good life anymore. Not like how it used to be. Not even when he was living with the cursed lotto numbers. It was a lot worse. Either way, he would not and could not admit that the problem would be solved by returning to the island. That his destiny relied on him boarding Flight 316. He still didn't see it, or at least, he still didn't know the reason why. There was nothing and no one to tell him why they were there. The only person who probably could was Locke. Problem was, he was in a coffin. Out of all of them, he was the only one who ever really believed they had a destiny. Like he knew why they were there and why this island wasn't a stinkhole. It was something special. Hurley thought he'd left those kind of thoughts behind, boarded the helicopter headed for home, but he hadn't. Thanks to a stranger in a taxi who encouraged him to follow what Locke had later told him. That his purpose was here. And that purpose was? He had no clue. Until he did, he would not gripe like Robert and Stuart. He would make the most of it. He would be living the silent promise that Jack and Kate and apparently Sawyer, now LaFleur, and Juliet made to themselves, even though they had no idea why they were doing what they were doing, living in 1977. After Hurley unloaded the box into the kitchen, he went back for more. He just passed Stuart on his way in with a box, now that they agreed complaining was over. Robert was leaning against the van, apparently fed up with the whole thing. Hurley went right on doing what he needed to do. Of course, he didn't have to do it. Not this part of the job, anyways. He was assigned as Chief of Dharma by Sawyer himself. At the time, Sawyer's comments on how he was practically made for the kitchen rubbed Hurley the wrong way. But he knew it was just Sawyer being Sawyer. Something he greatly missed since he sacrificed the opportunity to return home. It might not have ever happened. Hurley and the others might not have become Oceanic Six if Sawyer hadn't jumped the helicopter and saved it from being weighted down when it wanted to crash. For that, Hurley felt he owed it upon himself to follow as Sawyer instructed, not to raise any suspicions and, to his dislike, lie a little bit longer. No one was to know where or when they were actually from. In order to keep that lie and promise, Hurley needed to blend in and act like everyone else, and especially not do anything he wasn't told to do. "Hey, Reyes," said Robert, who'd been watching Hurley pile up two boxes together. "Why don't you go on back to the kitchen and leave the rest of this work to us? The old chefs around here never learnt so much as advised, let alone a helping hand." "No, it's cool, dude," said Hurley. "I don't mind." "Don't need you feeling sorry for us." "I'm not. I just want to help," said Hurley. It was true. He didn't have to do this part of the job, but he always took the opportunity to help someone. However, he had the feeling that Robert and Stuart didn't want his help. He could be wrong, but he had a feeling they didn't like him. Some of their tasteless jokes and complaints seemed to be directed at him. Sawyer and Juliet explained it wasn't anything to worry about. It was just the Dharma people weren't too trusting of outsiders, especially since they had the hostiles to deal with. "The floor give you any extra chores for the day?" "No, dude." "Course not," Robert said, with a hint of disliking him in his voice. "You're buddies, aren't you?" He moved away, purposely bumping into Hurley as he went back inside. "Jerk," Hurley whispered under his breath. He gathered up the boxes and went back inside.
Since both Stuart and Robert were too busy feeling sorry for themselves, Hurley unloaded the rest of the van on himself. That is, until a few of his co-workers in the kitchen saw him and decided to help out. Ever since Hurley became a chef, he had a newfound respect for all the chefs who worked in his favorite restaurant. Of course, he had worked around food at his first job, but was quickly fired for eating too much chicken and giving in to the customer's wishes. Sawyer assured him he could never be fired, and found it surprising when he confessed about losing his job. Sawyer joked that if he ever had to fire him, he would work as his personal cook. Hurley smiled at the thought and sat on the steps of the larger cafeteria compound. It was 5 o'clock, which meant his job was over for the day. He often spent it like this before going to his new home. Sitting on the steps, just thinking and chewing on some snack from the kitchen that was always candy. This time, it was a rich, chocolatey, smooth Apollo bar. He looked down at it, turning it in his hands. He remembered specifically the last time he ate one of those. "Come on, you wimp! Stop acting like a baby!" Hurley looked up at the sudden commotion that was happening before him. A group of boys had just shown up, not too far away from him, and decided to put on a show of bullying. The bullier, a rather tall, blonde kid with a bad attitude, the bully-e, a smaller, blonde-haired boy with glasses. It was a blonde-haired boy who shouted and then pushed the smaller boy to the ground, violently enough to knock off his glasses and the books he carried in his hand. The other boys gathered around, laughing. "Get up! Come on, I don't have all day!" The smaller boy reached for his glasses and put them back on. From the look of his face and his clothes, bullying had started elsewhere and was picking up again here. He wiped his arm across his bloodied lip and cast a dark look at the blonde. "He ain't getting up. He's too scared," said another boy. "You're such a loser. Why'd you come to this island? Nobody wants you. Not even your dad wants you." Hurley frowned, just as the boys seemed to be willing to stand up to them. His eyes saddened at the last remark. If he had any confidence in him at all, it was gone now. Tired of waiting, the blonde boy reached down and easily lifted him by the collar of his shirt to his feet. Hurley got to his feet. He had seen and heard enough. He pocketed the Apollo bar and marched up to him. He knew he shouldn't be doing this. He knew he shouldn't get involved like the few workers nearby who thought it was better for the kids to handle the situation on their own. Much like on the day when Sawyer and Jin fought and everyone else stepped aside to let them have it out. But not this time. He wasn't going to let that blonde kid beat the other one to a pulp regardless. "Hey, what are you doing?" They looked up, except the smaller boy, who looked away in shame. "Nothing," the blonde sneered, reminding Hurley of how Sawyer might have looked at his age. "Yeah? Well, it looks like you were up to something to me. Now get out of here before I tell the floor and have you fed to the sharks." There were mixed expressions among them, although none of them believed the bit about the sharks. What did he know about handling kid fights? They did buy the part about LaFleur. The blonde let go of the boy and turned away, showing him that hateful look Hurley was used. Yep. Every once in a while, somebody hated Hugo. Hurley watched the boys run off before turning to their unfortunate victim. He was still looking away from them, at the ground, apparently too ashamed to look him in the eye. Too ashamed to be seen as weak. Unable to fight back. At least at this age. Hurley wanted to feel sorry for him. But there were reasons why he couldn't. He wasn't supposed to have interfered at all. Not in this boy's life, anyway. LaFleur had told him why. He knew who this was, and there was a reason for it. But it wasn't right. It wasn't right not to do anything to help him. He was just a kid, after all. Hurley approached him awkwardly. Dude, you all right?" He didn't answer. "You know, I can get LaFleur for you. Tell him about those punks." Still nothing from the kid. Remembering how kids felt about tatling, he added more. "Or I could give him the crappy leftovers for their lunch tomorrow." The boy looked around with no particular expression on his face, except maybe he was a little curious. Hurley couldn't help looking at his bloody lip. When the boy saw this, he wiped his arm across it again. "They'll just do it again." "Not if you do something about it," Hurley said, suddenly feeling like he was influencing him, but he didn't catch the hint. He moved past him and sat right where Hurley had been sitting on the steps. Hurley watched. The feeling of sorrow for the boy overtaking him. He had been there, bullied when he was a kid for his weight. To see someone else go through it was always unbearable. He walked over and sat down on the boy's left.
There was silence, and a strange feeling of déjà vu. Hurley chanced to glance at him. He could particularly hear what he was thinking. The comment about his dad must have really struck him, though Hurley had never seen his dad. He couldn't believe it was true, not even for this kid. But then Hurley remembered his old man. How hard it was when he could no longer spend time with him because he abandoned him and his mother. What it was like not having him in his life. Hurley knew nothing of this boy, soon to be a most hated man. He wanted to know, at the same time he didn't. So the silence continued. Hurley needed to fill it. He wanted to fill it. But with the right words. You know, the same thing happened to me when I was your age. Kids used to tease me, beat me up all the time, because I was fat. Hurley looked down with thoughts of dark memories as the boy looked up with an incredulous look. Hurley turned in time to see his eyes drift down to his midsection before turning back around. Was fat? Don't suppose you've looked in the mirror lately, Hugo? That was just like him. He was as sarcastic as Sawyer, but full of lies. But today there were no lies. He was bullied as a young kid. But it wasn't as if anyone knew, nor were there any reasons to ask. I didn't always have someone to stand up for me, not even my old man. Again, the boy looked around. What do you know about my father? He asked, misunderstanding Hurley's meaning. Nothing, Hurley hurriedly replied. All I'm saying is, it's not always easy to deal with things on your own. I know what that's like, Ben. The boy raised his eyebrows. How do you know my name? Hurley shrugged. I just heard it around. It was uncanny. His stare was just the same as it would be when he grew up. Fortunately, he turned away again. You shouldn't listen to what those kids say. After a few moments, Ben answered. But they're right. My father didn't want me. No one does. I'm sure that's not true. Your mom... I don't have a mom. She died when I was a baby. An awkward silence filled the air. Oh, I'm sorry. So am I. I'd give anything to be with her, or away from this place, and him. Well, do you ever think of talking to him about it? How can I? He's so drunk half the time, he probably wouldn't know what I was saying. So that's it. That was the reason, or maybe part of the reason, why Ben acted the way he did. Hurley knew how the situations of parents could affect a child all the way into adulthood, but this was just an assumption. Another awkward silence. This really wasn't turning out the way he expected it to. He didn't know what to say next. It probably wouldn't have mattered. Ben would still grow up to be a lying, manipulative bastard. But he could still offer something. Look, dude, parents make mistakes. We all do. And in time they start to realize it, like my old man. He ran out on me and my mom when I was little, but he came back. It wasn't for what I hoped, but in a way he kind of helped me. Hurley looked around and continued as he saw he had Ben's full attention. So I guess what I'm saying is, people deserve a second chance. You might not understand that now, but I hope you will when you grow up. Hurley was meeting his gaze. No longer was there any intensity behind Ben's eyes, the kind that made you want to look away. They were soft and hopeful. They were innocent, a child's eyes. Hurley knew right then he had done the right thing. He was right in confronting his attackers and having a heart-to-heart talk with the future terror. Even though Hurley knew the fate of the Dharma Initiative, including Ben's father, who he now knew was among them, he liked to think that there was some form of understanding in humanity that would exist in Ben because of this talk. Who knows? Maybe Hurley had always had this talk with Ben because he was supposed to. Maybe it had allowed him to have love for his daughter. Who knows? All he knew was that he was right there to help those in need because he wanted to, not because someone told him to, or in this case, not to. It felt good. Ben sniffed and rubbed at his nose. Hurley was sure of it now. Some of what he said sunk through. Ben turned away again, but he didn't look down. He was looking straight ahead. He even sat up. It was just like in the future when they sat, waiting for Locke to return from the cabin. It had been uncomfortable at first, but the moment became less tense with a certain truce. Hurley reached down in his pocket and pulled out the infamous Apollo bar. He turned it in his hands, the smile came to his face. Ben looked around just as before, curious. He looked at Hurley. Hurley looked at him, then down at the candy bar. Without saying anything, Hurley opened it up. Ben was still watching. Hurley carefully broke it in half, probably in the same place as last time, he mused, and looked around at Ben. He handed him the packaged half of the candy. With a minute's hesitation and a confirming look at Hurley, Ben took it. But before Hurley consumed his bet, he watched Ben as he carefully put down the wrapping and wordlessly took a bite. Hurley gave a smile. There was a feeling that the reason for that moment in the future was understood. Hurley then tossed his half of the candy into his mouth. Thank goodness for Apollo bars. Author's note. He shared it because it was something he did in the past. I love writing this, and I hope to write more little Ben fics. I just love the oddness of Ben and Hurley, and I hope you do too. It was a bit challenging, considering what Hurley would say to help Ben, but he seems to have said it all with an Apollo bar. An icon of truce and friendship on the show. Be on the lookout for possibilities of more. The end.
Before we go into our last tale, I realize I have an international audience. However, I want to help out all of you, as I always do. Last Saturday, I witnessed the World Cup game between England and the United States. Many people in the United States were confused as to how getting a tie actually was somewhat of a victory. The reason for this is, in the first round, the four teams will each play each other, and the top two teams will advance into the next round. However, England regarded that as a loss because the Wizarding World of Harry Potter is located in the United States. Because there isn't a real Hogwarts in England, they are really struck. In fact, I'm going to have to apologize in advance for my horrible, horrible English accent that I'm about to read this next tale with.
Pretentious Internet Theater proudly presents Lost on the Island by Cherry One. Author's note.
Okay, I'm a huge Lost fan, and I've toyed with the idea of having the Doctor crash land on the island since everything else does. I've never done any Lost fan fiction before, so I'm hoping this'll turn out okay. This story will be a parody, too, since I've thought about exaggerating some of the things on the island and the way the islanders act for comedy purposes. So here goes.
Chapter 1.
Right then, where to next, Miss Tyler?
The doctor said to Rose as the ship spun through the vortex.
Not sure. How about we go meet some famous people?
And is there anyone you have in mind? He asked. Suddenly, there was a violent lurch that knocked them both off their feet. Rose grunted as she landed hard on her side, and the doctor let out a grunt as his stomach slammed into the jump seat. He and Rose held on to the railing for dear life as the TARDIS spun out of control. Then, with a boom, the TARDIS slammed down, and all the lights went off.
"Rose, are you all right?" I think so," Rose moaned. "What happened? It was kind of like when we
fell through the void in the other universe," the doctor finished. His eyes widened in terror. Working instinctually, he pressed buttons and flicked switches in the dark, while Rose held out her hands and walked towards the front door. The doctor shielded his eyes when she threw open the door and continued working, trying to get the power to come back on.
"Come on, girl, you can do this. Come back to me. I don't want to give 10 more years of my life away," he muttered as he ran around the console. "Doctor!"
The doctor paused and noticed Rose was standing outside. She peered in at him.
"Come here. You need to see this."
The doctor walked down the ramp, out the door, and froze. He looked around and noticed they were on the outskirts of a large forest, and behind the TARDIS was a large grass plain that stretched on for about a mile until it ran into another forest. Towering above it was a large mountain. There was a warm breeze blowing, and the doctor took a moment to enjoy it while he wondered where the hell they were at.
"Well, not London, that's for sure," he said to Rose.
Curiosity overwhelmed him, and using the excuse of finding someone or finding parts that would help restore the TARDIS, he shut the door, and he and Rose walked away across the wide plain. The doctor put his hands in his pockets as he calmly strode across the plain, while Rose struggled to keep up with him. The doctor looked absolutely in control, manly beyond belief, as each step hit the ground with purpose. Meanwhile, Rose was looking all over, hoping she didn't step into a rabbit hole and break her leg. They got halfway across the field, and the doctor had now gotten himself into a rhythm, his steps hitting the ground. Left, right, left, right. The wind blew around his tousled hair and his nose hairs gently in the breeze as he kept up his manly march toward wherever it was on the other side of the plain.
Doctor!
Not now, Rose. I've got a rhythm going.
Yes, but...
Just then, the doctor heard a low, loud growling.
For heaven's sake, Rose, control your stomach. You just had chips,
he said as he kept up his stride.
That wasn't me,
Rose said in a low voice. The doctor stopped short as he thought that over. Then he heard the low growl again and slowly turned around. His eyes nearly popped from his head when he saw a huge polar bear running towards them. It was 20 feet away and closing fast, without meaning to. The doctor gave out a high-pitched Mickey Smith scream. He spun around and ran with Rose towards the other side of the plane as fast as he could go. They both ran hell for leather as the massive bear bore down onto them. They had almost reached the other side when Rose hazarded a glance back and noticed the polar bear was gone. She stopped the doctor, and both of them scanned the plane, but the bear had vanished.
Okay, that was odd, the doctor said. Rose, when we visit your mom again, don't mention that we were chased by a polar bear in a warm, sunny day. Anyway, back to my manly stride and looking for help.
He spun around and was off of his rhythm again as Rose hurried to keep up with him. They headed into the forest, and the doctor noticed a little path going through the woods that was nice, since that meant that he could do his manly I'm in charge and I'm Studley walk of his without tripping on a limb and falling flat on his face. No, the last thing he wanted was for Rose to see him trip up and fall, since he knew that he was setting an example for his young assistant, who naturally looked up to him and had a great set of *** on top of that. They walked on, the doctor looking left and right, his eagle eyes studying every rock, leaf, and Rose's bountiful breasts. His last examination he did without her knowing about it. But when she finally did cotton on, he quickly swiveled his head back around, looked at a caterpillar climbing up a tree trunk.
"Oh, look at the pretty caterpillar," he said in an attempt to fool Rose into thinking he'd been staring at that all along,
and not her two enormous jugs, which were bouncing up and down in her loose white tank top. The doctor considered that as they walked along. After all, it wasn't too long ago he'd been a happy little asexual alien, just flying through time and space, minding his own business, and then, one morning, there they were, Rose's rack right in front of him, and suddenly his long-dead ding-dong rose to attention and took notice. After that, it was nothing but thoughts of Rose's TNA, and sometimes getting them both for a poor man. But why did he suddenly feel the need to ride his companion like a pony around the console room? After all, he came from a logical race, sort of like Mr. Spock, except with better ears, and eyebrows, and hair. Okay, he was dead sexy compared to Spock. That wasn't the point. The point was he wasn't supposed to lust after his buxom little assistant. Well, then again, there was Grace Holloway. But be fair, he was in America, land of hedonistic pleasures. He'd just given in for a short time to his long-dead urges. Tried to get in Grace's pants. Is that so bad? Then there was Perry and her need to wear tight clothes and short that rode up so far he could see her pubic hair. And for one brief, maddening moment, he thought about tearing off his multicolored eyesore of an outfit and tearing off the handkerchief she called an outfit and boinking her on top of the central column while it went up and down. But he had a perfectly good explanation for that particular fit of madness. He was insane in the sixth life. That's why he wore clothes louder than a sonic boom with little cat badges that screamed out gay person everywhere he went. Then again, the doctor seemed to recall one night getting up for a cup of tea after he met Rose.
And suddenly, a bespectacled man jumped out of the shadows of the TARDIS corridor, armed with a ray gun.
"Who are you?" the doctor demanded.
"I am Russell T. Davis, and this is my show now. And you're going to ignore 45 years of canon and be hornier than a 10-mile parade of brass bands. And to help you going, here's my Viagra ray."
"Your what?"
That's the last words he said as an asexual, because Russell hit him with that ray, and Wee Willie Winky was never the same again. And now, walking along in this tropical paradise, Wee Willie was screaming at him to wake up, rip Rose's clothes off, and bang her senseless against the nearest palm tree.
"No, I must resist," the doctor thought to himself. "I am a Time Lord, and she's a human. Even though we look the same and have the same parts and speak English and like chips, it must be because there's a curse about me."
The doctor frowned. When did that happen? He never thought of his life as a curse. Then again, he reasoned the bespectacled man with the Viagra gun put that in his thoughts in order to create angst and make millions of fans tear their hair out in frustration, since they were also waiting for him to get naked and throw up against a palm tree.
The doctor was so confused with these thoughts that he didn't realize there was a bald man in front of him pointing a gun at his face until he smacked into the muzzle of it. He backed up in shock and swiveled around to stare at Rose.
"Why didn't you tell me that was there?" he said, pointing to the bald, sweaty man with the gun.
"I thought you were going to attack him," Rose said, shrugging.
"No, I wasn't. I was thinking," he said. "And a lot of help you were. You're supposed to warn me when I'm about to walk into guns," and
he trailed off as his eyes landed on the soft mounds of flesh under her tank top. He watched, transfixed, as they moved up and down slightly with her breathing, and Wee Willie was screaming at him to make a move. Then he felt the muzzle of the gun against the back of his head, and he wanted nothing more than to rip it from Q-Ball's hands and beat him to death for interrupting his view of paradise.
"Who are you, and what are you doing here?" Q-Ball said in a gruff voice.
The doctor bit back the urge to scream. "I'm the doctor, and I'm about to boink my companion against a palm tree."
Instead, he calmly turned around and instantly adopted the "I'm in charge, you're not, so don't argue with me" look he gave people who he wished to exert his boundless authority over. The man wasn't scared or impressed in the least. He just stood there with his gun aimed at them, waiting for an answer.
"I'm the doctor," he said, figuring that would instantly answer any question of Q-Ball's, which would free up valuable time that he needed to be his natural "I'm the Lord and Master here" stuff.
But he's not the master. The master's the master. He's the doctor.
"Doctor who?" the man said.
The doctor's eyelid twitched. He hated that question with a passion. He'd had to restrain himself. Least he'd go off on Q-Ball and beat his shiny Mr. Clean head in with his own gun.
"Just the doctor," he said, giving him the same answer he'd given 40 trillion other dumb yokels who'd asked.
The man grunted. "Name's Locke. John Locke."
The doctor stared at him. John Locke, the philosopher? If this was him, he needed some Rogaine and the razor to the face pretty damned fast. Then again, what was John Locke the philosopher doing out in the middle of polar bear infested tropical paradise? And for that matter, what was the bleeding polar bear doing out in the middle of polar bear infested tropical paradise? And for that matter, who was the fat lump coming up behind John Locke, scooping up handfuls of peanut butter that came out of a large can of Dharma Initiative brand peanut butter and cramming it into his gob like he was going to be dead in 40 seconds and needed his last meal pronto? Fat Boy stopped directly beside the famed philosopher.
"Dude, who are these people?"
"Aha!" the doctor thought. "Obviously a stoner having some peanut butter after smoking an enormous doobie. Now it all fits. I'm so brilliant and handsome, too, unlike Spock. Yep, Mr. Spock is an ugly, pointy-eared bastard compared to me. And I can think circles around Mr. Pointy Ears any day. Yep, I'm definitely God's gift to the universe and..."
"Hey, buddy, you haven't answered my question," John Locke, the philosopher, growled. "What are you doing here?"
"Well, I'm the doctor, as I said, and my companion Rose and I were traveling in my ship, minding our own business, when we suddenly crash-landed here.
Then we were chased by a polar bear and it disappeared, which made me wonder if I didn't catch a whiff of Stoner Boy's joint here, and my companion and I were off on some funky marijuana-induced trip, which would explain the polar bear. And then again, unlike Fat and Scraggly over there, I'm not hungry at the moment. I was under the impression you smoke a joint and you suddenly want to eat everything in sight and... Wait, you have a ship? John Locke, the famous and very bald philosopher, said as he cut into the doctor's rambling. The doctor's eyelids twitched. "Excuse me, did you dare interrupt me in the middle of one of my patented rantings?" he said. "Because I didn't give you the permission to speak." And he suddenly shut the hell up when John Locke, the famed and evidently pissed off philosopher, fired his shotgun once in the air before leveling at his head. "Your ship, take us to it," he growled at the doctor. The doctor sighed a world-weary, why-must-I-deal-with-insane-gun-toting-philosophers kind of sigh, and beckoned to him and the fat stoner dude. Then he and Rose turned around and walked back across the plain towards the TARDIS. Chapter 2. The doctor and Rose trudged back across the plain towards the TARDIS. This time, the doctor's gat was not the usual self-assured gat he used when he knew that he was the smartest thing around. It was more of a stomping gat that defined to the world he was about to ram Q-Ball's gun up a very private and very painful place if he didn't get it away from the back of his head. As they were walking, Fat Boy was talking to Q-Ball about the TARDIS. "Dude, if they have a ship, we can finally get off this island," Bad Boy was saying. "I asked them to take me to their ship, but not so we can get off the island," John Locke, the gun-toting philosopher, replied. "I want them to take me to it so I can blow it up." The doctor, not sure if he'd heard right, spun around and grunted when Locke kept going and the barrel of the gun hit his Adam's apple. "Sorry, I don't think I heard you right," he said as everyone stopped. "You're going to blow my ship up."
"That's right, I am," Locke said.
"Dude, why would you do that?" Fat Boy asked.
"Because, Hugo, no one is leaving the island. Everyone who comes here is here for a purpose. This is your destiny," he said to the doctor.
"Uh-huh," the doctor said. "And, how do you know this is my destiny?"
John Locke, the militant and slightly insane philosopher, turned his eyes skyward for a moment. The doctor and Rose looked up with him as they wondered what the hell he's looking at. Then John Locke, the really weird gun-toting philosopher, looked at both of them and smiled.
"This island speaks to me. It told me that you need to be here," he said.
There was a hushed silence, broken only by the smacking of Hurley's lips as he chowed down his peanut butter. For several seconds, the doctor and John stared at one another. Then, very slowly, the doctor and Rose began to back away.
"Right," the doctor said as he backed away. "Sure, Mr. Locke, why don't you have a nice lie down? Maybe landmasses won't talk to you anymore, okay?"
"You can't escape," Locke said, following after him. "No matter where you go, the island will keep you here. And not only that, it'll show you things. Things you may not want to see."
"Like the barrel of your gun," the doctor said.
"You'll see I'm right, doctor.
Island will help you if you let it."
"Yeah, right. I'll pass on that. Thanks, Rose."
"Yes, doctor."
"Run!" he bellowed.
They ran away, across the plain towards the other side and the safety of the woods. While they ran, the doctor prayed that Nutty wouldn't shoot and blow his brains out. So far in his lives, he'd been lucky in avoiding being shot to death by someone. Wait a moment. On second thought, he did die in a shooting, but that particular shooting was embarrassing, and he'd put it out of his mind. Because, come on, after facing Daleks and Cybermen and the Master, the Doctor, the oncoming storm dies in a gangbang by a bunch of Asian teens? Nope, not gonna count that one. No siree, Bob, top embarrassing. So as I was saying, the Doctor had never been shot before. So he had no idea what it was going to feel like. But in the end, he didn't have to worry, because they'd made it to the woods without any hot lead projectiles entering their bodies. Then another strange thing happened. The TARDIS was not where he parked it. The doctor looked all around, trying to find his missing time ship, and when Rose suddenly pointed out its location, the doctor's mouth dropped open. Because the TARDIS was now
way up, on the top of a cliff, about 10 miles from their location. It was perched on the edge, as if it was watching them.
That's not where I parked, the doctor said, pointing up to her.
The doctor was now incensed. This was turning out to be a very bad day. A polar bear nearly ran him down, and he was sure he would have been eaten and turned into polar poo. He met a bald, gun-toting philosopher and a fat, peanut-butter-eating stoner who were both completely certifiable. And now, the TARDIS had decided to play the temporal ship version of sit in the car, wait for your younger sister to try to get in and then hit the gas and drive up a few feet while you giggle at her game. The doctor was furious, but he knew that his buxom young companion looked up to him, and he must never show emotion in front of her. So, putting on an unconcerned face, he gave Rose his most winning, "Nothing's wrong with me at all," smile, and said sweetly, "Rose, could you be a lamb in wait here? I've got to do something." Rose nodded and stood patiently, while the doctor calmly walked past her into a dense part of the forest. Her eyes widened when 20 seconds later she heard, "Gah!" And then, 10 seconds after that, the doctor came bounded back to her side, convinced she hadn't heard a thing. "Right then," he said, slapping his hands together. "Shall we go get my TARDIS so I can give her a good spanking for her naughty behavior?"
"You what?" Rose said. "You spank your TARDIS when she's bad?"
The doctor stared at her with a deer caught in the headlights look. He slowly passed his hand in front of his body when he said, "You didn't just hear me say that."
"Doctor, for the 1,000th time, the Jedi mind trick doesn't work," Rose said.
"It does work," the doctor said, passing his hand in front of his body.
"No, it doesn't."
"Okay, how about I put my fingers up to your temples and erase your memories? That does work, trust me."
No need for that. I never heard you said you spank your TARDIS," Rose said quickly.
"Good, shall we proceed?" They both started off along a narrow dirt path that the doctor hoped would take them straight to the TARDIS. While they walked, the doctor kept glancing back over his shoulder, but Q-Ball and Fat Boy hadn't followed them. Happy that he was alone with bum and breasts, he resumed his natural, exuberant, happy-go-lucky, "I'm in charge and you're not" walk. As they walked, they were unaware of a large black smoke creature that was slowly stalking them from behind. It had nearly reached them when it passed over a little twig, and the twig snapped. The smoke monster cursed softly as the doctor and Rose turned.
What is that?"
"Well, I'm pretty sure it's not a big bonfire or roast frankfurters and marshmallows." They gasped when the monster suddenly glided towards them. With another shout of "Run!", the two of them sped off down the path with the smoke monster in pursuit. Rose looked behind her and darted off to the left, hoping the smoke creature would become confused. She cursed when it started following her instead.
"I hate this bloody island!"
The doctor ran and ran and ran, panting and gasping and cursing this stupid island and its polar bears and killer smoke. Then, after running about 1/2 mile, he'd slowed down and paused for a moment while he listened. He couldn't hear anything behind him, so he turned, and that's when he noticed Rose wasn't with him.
Rose, hello," he said, looking around.
He got a sinking feeling in the pit of his stomach when he noticed the smoke monster wasn't around either.
"No," he said in a hushed, dramatic whisper.
He slowly sank to his knees as he stared at the forests in a numbed silence. Slowly, he began to shake his head, and he let out a ragged sob as one lone tear streaked down his cheek.
"No," he said in a hushed whisper. "Rose, you can't be dead. You have to be alive."
The sorrow was replaced by determination, and he leapt to his feet.
"No," he said with a determined, steely gaze. "Rose is alive, and I will find her if I have to rip this place apart."
He struck a heroic pose. Then he was amazed when he saw a fat, balding white guy in a gray business suit step through the trees, carrying a large, bulky briefcase.
"Hi, great acting," he said with an American accent as he shook the doctor's hand.
"I wasn't acting," the doctor said.
"I know. You acted that scene so well, it felt like it wasn't acting," the man gushed.
I'm sorry, who are you?
I'm Gerald Grubermeier of the American chapter of the I Love the Doctor fan club. Are you aware of just how many Yanks are in America that want to jump your bones?
The doctor gave him an odd look. No.
No? Why, there's literally thousands of them, all horny for you. But that's not why I'm here. I'm here because every American wanted to reward you for your awesome acting skills. And so, here you go. Congratulations.
He opened up the briefcase, pulled out an Oscar statue, and handed it to him.
Here you go. You just won yourself an Academy Award.
According to the plaque on this base, isn't this 1939 Gone with the Wind Best Picture Award?
Yeah, well, David O. Selznick's dead now, and can't take these things to heaven now, can you? He let out a boisterous laugh that lasted a whole minute as the doctor stared at him in a stunned silence. When Gerard finished, he clapped the doctor so hard on the back he grunted. Well, anyway, gotta get back to my wife and kids in San Bernardino. Gotta think up an alibi for stealing that thing, you know. But you enjoy this Oscar. You've earned it. Have fun on the island!
The doctor stared at him as he walked back into the woods and vanished into thin air.
Chapter 3
Rose! The doctor called out as he walked down the path. Rose! Oh, Rosa!
He stopped, scratched his head. Now where did that nubile young minx get to? He pondered as he looked around. Rose! Rose!
Yeah?
The doctor's head jerked around when he saw a middle-aged black woman emerging from the trees.
What?
The doctor said when she stood and looked at him impatiently.
What?
The woman replied.
What?
The doctor retorted.
You called me, the woman said impatiently. No, I called for Rose.
I am Rose. What do you want? The doctor chuckled.
No, my Rose. Here, take a look.
He reached deep into his trouser pocket, pulled out a Polaroid, and handed it to her.
My Rose, he said proudly.
Rose stared at the photo.
Your Rose seems to be masturbating, she said to him.
The doctor's eyes widened as he snatched the photo from her. His worst fear was confirmed. It was the hidden camera photo he'd taken of Rose while she was in her bedroom pleasuring herself. He quickly stuffed the photo back in his pocket, and by stuffed I mean put it back, not the sexual stuffed. The doctor frowned.
What was that?
He asked the narrator.
What was what? The narrator said. That aside you put in brackets about how you used to clarify the use of the word stuffed, what was that?
I'm an American, and stuffed doesn't mean what you think it means over here, the narrator said.
Why didn't you use a word that didn't have any sexual meaning in England? Then you wouldn't need to clarify.
Because I didn't want to. I'm lazy. Besides, it's what you did with the photo. You stuffed it back in your pocket.
I did no such thing. I put it gently back in my pocket, the doctor protested.
No, you definitely stuffed it in your pocket. I saw you, the narrator said smugly.
No, I... Why the hell am I even arguing with you?
Because you're weird. The doctor gave the narrator a dirty look before he decided to ignore her and continue with the story.
Now where were we? He said to Rose.
The doctor, who is a completely wimpy little pansy, began asking Rose if he'd seen...
Excuse me, the doctor said to the narrator. I'm what now?
The narrator was silent. The doctor snorted and turned his attention back to Rose.
Anyway, I was saying, I'm looking for my companion, Rose Tyler. Have you seen her?
No, haven't heard of anyone by that name. Is she an other? Rose said.
Other?
The doctor replied, confused.
Yeah, an other.
Yeah, an other. The other people who live on this island, said the narrator. Don't you watch the show, you geeky, pencil-thin dork?
Oi, if you don't stop that, I'm going to have you replaced, the doctor said, jabbing his finger at the sky. Don't think I won't. I'll do it in an artsbeat.
Shaking his hand, he looked at Rose.
I don't know where your friend is. I'm sorry. I was out here searching for Bernard. He's run off again. Well, why don't we help each other? We can both look for Bernard and Rose.
Rose narrowed her eyes.
Okay, but I have to get back to our camp first for some supplies. I don't know if I should bring you, though. What if you're another?
I can assure you I'm not, because I have no idea who the others are, so therefore I can't be one of them. No, he can't be another,
because he's just a pencil-thin, willy-white douchebag.
Could you excuse me for a moment? The doctor said between clenched teeth.
Rose stood and watched while the doctor walked away. A few minutes later, she'd heard the sound of someone getting the snot pummeled out of them, and then the narrator begging for mercy. A short time after that, the doctor walked back to Rose, wiping blood of his hands with a handkerchief.
Right, I don't think we'll be hearing any more cheeky comments from the narrator, he said to Rose. So, where was I? Oh yes, take me to your camp.
Dr. Jack Shepherd stood at the beach, looking towards the forest that was on the perimeter of their camp. It had been 55 days since their plane had crashed on the island, leaving the survivors stranded in a harsh environment that now included the threat of mysterious people known as the Others. They had also managed to find survivors on the back half of the plane. The Tailies, as they were called, were struggling to fit in with the rest of the survivors. Jack, the designated leader, was trying to find a happy balance between both groups so everyone could live and work together. It wasn't easy, especially since Anna Lucia, the leader of the Tailies, was used to being in charge and getting her own way. But working with her was a piece of cake compared to Locke. Jack sighed angrily. The Nut had gone into the woods again, another one of his vision quest hunts, talked with the island. Whatever the hell it was, Jack was incensed that he was off screwing around while he should be helping him manage the camp and take care of the survivors. Shaking his head, Jack walked over to Sawyer's tent. Sawyer was sitting under a palm tree, relaxing and reading another one of his books that he'd found in someone's luggage. Jack paused a moment, as curiosity set in, and he leaned over to look at the title of the book. "The Stone Rose?" Jack muttered. Sawyer grinned as he put the book down. "Not a bad little book. About this man called the Doctor, who's an alien. He's in love with a woman named Rose. Turns out to be a statue, and..." "Yeah, whatever," Jack said, and not caring. "Have you seen Locke today?" "Nope, Chief. Don't keep tabs on Baldy. Leaves me alone, I'll leave him alone." "Yeah, well, I'm getting tired of him wandering off without telling anyone where he's going," Jack replied. "Needs to be here, helping out in the camp."
"Think the people in the camp are more than capable of taking care of themselves, Doc,"
Sawyer replied.
"So why don't you relax a little and get that stick out of your ass before you had a stroke or something?"
Jack's mouth fell open. "Excuse me," Jack said angrily. "You heard me. Relax a little. All of us are more than capable of taking care of ourselves. We did it before we met you, and I think we still know how to do it even though your boss and everyone around. So why don't you go find Freckles and see if she needs a bit of an examination, huh?"
Jack was minutes away from punching the smug look off his face when he felt someone tap him on the shoulder. He turned to see Jin behind him, frantically pointing off to the left. He looked where he was pointing and saw Rose emerging from the trees, followed by a tall, thin, gangly man who had his hands in his pockets of his pinstripe pants. Everyone around them instantly leapt to their feet, suspicious of the new intruder.
"Well, well, seems Rose just found us another other," Sawyer said, getting up from his spot.
"Everyone calm down, I'll handle this," Jack said as the other survivors began to panic and back away from them. He walked up to Rose.
"Rose, who is this?" he said to her.
"I'm the Doctor. Nice to meet you," the Doctor said, extending his hand.
"Doctor who?" The Doctor's eyelids twitched.
"Just the Doctor," he sighed.
Jack folded his arms over his chest.
"So you're not going to tell us who you are then?"
Yeah, I'm the Doctor. I just said that," the Doctor said.
"Doctor who?"
"Just the Doctor."
Jack threw up his arms. He looked around and motioned for Saeed to come towards him.
"Saeed, got another one who won't cooperate with us," Jack said to them.
"I am cooperating. You asked me my name, and I said it. I'm the Doctor."
Saeed came up beside Jack.
"What would you like me to do?"
Saeed asked Jack. "Interrogate him. Find out what he knows," Jack replied. The Doctor's eyes widened when Saeed smiled and cracked his knuckles.
"With pleasure," Saeed said.
Mummy,
the Doctor said in a small falsetto voice as some of the other survivors grabbed him and dragged him away.
The end.
As with the series Lost, all good things must come to an end, and so must this episode. But yay, though the doors in the back of the church may open so that white light can come pouring forth. Always remember, there is much drama on the internet, but only the best makes pretentious internet theater. Good night, and the pleasure was all yours.